And good morning, or good evening, or good afternoon, or early, early dawn, or wherever you are on this fascinating spinning globe that we try to bring you every morning in terms of new things, new discoveries, new ideas, new connections. The other side of midnight, where after sunset and before dawn, the things that appear kind of crazy during daylight take on a whole new meaning at this time of night, or morning, or afternoon, wherever you happen to be. You know, the difference between doing this show and doing many, many decades ago when I used to do radio is that we really reach the world. I mean, I'm getting emails from all over the world from fascinating people. And when we open lines, and hopefully tonight with Michael we can actually have some open lines, you know, we really can't do open lines with very complex subjects and fascinating guests until we get the third hour. So the more of you who join Club 19.5, the closer the third hour will come. Hint, hint. First of all, tonight I want to do one major, major thing. Rich Roland had a birthday. I think technically it was yesterday, but, you know, to me, birthdays are a state of mind, and I like the 12 days of Christmas because why should you put all that joy on one morning? So we will, you know, welcome Rich and wish him a belated happy birthday. Rich Roland, that is, who is Scotty's son, Keith Roland's son. And I hope you have many, 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 many more, particularly in association with this show. The second thing I want to do this morning is I want to kind of recap what we did last night, which was our conversation with Richard Spence, Dr. Richard Spence. We talked for like an hour and a half, maybe 90 minutes, about this amazing thing that happened in Utah back in 1917, 1918, where the precursor to the FBI, the BI, the Bureau of Investigation, as part of the U.S. Justice Department, actually began, apparently, the first official investigation into UFOs in American history. And this was something that Rick Spence just kind of discovered serendipitously as he was going through online files as part of his professorial work at the University of Idaho, where he is a professor of history, if you heard the show yesterday morning. And if you didn't, I strongly recommend for all of you who are Club 19.5ers that you go and listen, because it's an extraordinary story. And the end of the story has not been written yet, because we don't know what those guys in Utah saw back in 1917. We don't know whether it was an extraordinarily complex and elaborate hoax. And we don't know what the lights in the sky that it was kind of playing out against in terms of Agent Bone, who was the BI agent, the precursor FBI agent, who really eerily mirrors Fox Mulder. I mean, it's like, I wonder, when we get Chris Carter on the show, and he's coming, Chris Carter will come, he will be here, you will all have a chance to listen to him. By then, we may have a third hour. And we'll have a chance to get your calls and your input and your questions and your take and your perspectives on the resurgence and reincarnation of X-Files. But I do need to ask Carter, did he ever, ever hear of this lone FBI agent's valiant attempt to probe the unknown at a time when even ordinary aircraft were something of a marvel and a mystery and a miracle? All that for a future time. But the reason I wanted to recap what Rick Spence was telling us is tonight our guest is Michael Cremo, who has been a friend of mine, a personal friend of mine and Robin, since we shared a cruise together. We were actually on a ship bound for Chichen Itza in 2012, just before the solstice. And I've never had a chance to kind of debrief Michael about that trip and what he learned, because we went to a really extraordinary place in the Mayan country, in the Yucatan Peninsula. And then on the way back, we had this really amazing storm at sea. We had pitching waves and pitching ship. And, you know, it kind of reminded me of the tragedy of this lost cargo vessel off the Bahamas during the hurricane. Because although it wasn't called a hurricane, what we went through kind of looked out the portholes and out the windows like a hurricane. And, you know, we were supposed to be doing sky watching on decks, and the crew had to use yellow tape and cordon off various decks so errant passengers wouldn't wind up flying off the ship and into the ocean, never to be seen again. So that was kind of an interesting adventure that Michael and I and Robin had, and a whole bunch of other people. We had hundreds of people on that trip who were bound for Maya country, and we might talk a bit about that tonight. But to give you a background, all you folks who don't know who Michael Cremo is, and the reason that this connects to what Spence and I were talking about last night, is that Michael, of course, is looking at ancient archaeological anomalies. And one of my theories, one of my models, is that an awful lot of the current UFO stuff, in fact, is not aliens. It's not, you know, weird little gray guys and all that. It's basically family. It's basically someone who's related, part of the human family, who just kind of don't happen to live here anymore. They live out there somewhere. You know, third star on the left, straight on till morning. And so if the folks that in Utah who were seeing something in the sky that was really an alien vehicle or alien set of vehicles, extraterrestrial vehicles, it's not necessarily so that they were aliens. They certainly most likely were not secret government craft in 1917, and hardly. But they could have been members of the family trying to intervene, as I said last night, to try to make things better, because things really on this planet have not been going very well for the last, 10,000 years, something like that? I mean, just look at our history, and what do we do? What's our primary human occupation? I just, commend your attention to CNN or Fox or MSNBC or CBS or ABC, and you can see what our human pastime happens to be, except now we do it with far more sophisticated weapons and technology than we used to do it. So, getting back to Michael, one of his titles has been Forbidden Archaeologist. He is hailed as a groundbreaking pioneer and international authority on archaeological anomalies. He first came to my attention when he wrote a book called Forbidden Archaeology, a bestseller, first published in 1993 with his co-author Richard Thompson. It's now been translated into 26 languages, and it challenged the very foundation of Darwinian evolution. Michael continues his career, his anomalistic archaeological career, by digging up discoveries in the fossil record, shaking up accepted paradigms, exploring famous archaeological sites, journeying to sacred places like in India, and appearing on many national television shows in the U.S. and other countries. He's lectured at mainstream science conferences, has spoken to alternative gatherings of global intelligentsia, and he crosses disciplinary and cultural boundaries, presenting his various audiences a compelling case for negotiating a new consensus on the nature of reality and the nature of who we really are. Now, the thing that's striking to me, and I want to actually start here, is that he actually began as a kind of a straight-laced student of international affairs at George Washington University, and then he kind of got into studying ancient Sanskrit. And that was all they wrote. That apparently sealed his fate, set his course, set his direction into the ancient prehistory of the human species and trying to discover who are we really and what are we all doing in this place. And welcome, Michael, to the other side of midnight.
To be with you and all your listeners.
Well, it's nice that you were with us. So let me start at the beginning for you. You were enrolled at George Washington University, studying international affairs. How did you go from that to what you obviously have been doing for the last several decades?
Well, first, just let me say a little bit about how I wound up studying international affairs.
Oh, okay.
You know, my father was an intelligence officer in the United States Air Force. So I grew up among people in the intelligence services, the diplomatic services, and so on and so forth. So at that stage in my life, when people would ask me, what are you going to do when you go to college or whatever, I naturally followed in the family groove. I thought, okay, I'll go to one of the universities that trains people for occupations in the intelligence services or the diplomatic service, the George Washington University School of International Relations being one of them.
Didn't Bill Clinton go there?
Huh?
Didn't Bill Clinton go there?
I'm not sure that.
Or was that Georgetown? I always get the two confused.
Yeah, Georgetown is. I was also accepted at Georgetown University, but George Washington gave me a better scholarship.
A determining factor in many things, yes.
Yeah. So I went there in 1966 and wound up studying the foreign languages that were most useful in those fields at that time, German and Russian, and international politics and economics and finance and all of that. And but it was a pretty tumultuous time, and I would say my career ambitions did not survive my exposure to the different countercultural movements that were very prominent at that time.
You mean the 1960s?
And, yeah. And so I began looking for alternatives, and I was a little bit disappointed with what I call the knowledge factory aspect of the modern educational system, and I started looking for to find other ways for educating myself about, you know, the nature of reality and what's really true.
Oh, my God, you actually took the idea of education seriously.
Yeah.
Well, most people go through a diploma mill to get a degree, to get a job, to get security, to have a family, to stash money away so they can retire and travel the world. I mean, it sounds to me like you actually thought, wait a minute, I can actually find out something.
Yeah, I was more interested in experiential ways of arriving at truth. And I mean, you're touching on a whole issue. I think for some people the more structured forms of education are probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to go through a whole system that's been set up like that. But for other people, it may not be the best way for them to get a real education, as you say. Because I guess most modern universities today are consortiums of the universities and governments and corporations, you know, with very specific goals. You know, if you do research in a modern university, it's probably a consortium between the university, government agencies, and high-powered corporations and financial interests.
And you rarely advance if you step outside the lines.
Yes. There's, I mean, that's got a lot to do, I think, with a lot of the issues we're discovering, whether it's about archaeological anomalies or UFO sightings or any other types of what are sometimes called paranormal events.
I hate that term.
So so when I was looking for a new pathway of knowledge, I was drawn to the ancient wisdom traditions of the world, the ones that had survived for thousands and thousands of years. And the one that attracted my attention most was the spiritual tradition of ancient India. So I eventually became the disciple of a guru from India.
Now, do you know why that kind of attracted you?
Well, you know,
I mean, looking back, obviously at the time you were just looking for a path, but and now with everything you found under your belt, do you kind of think maybe there was a higher resonance going on?
I think it has to do with my having practiced some variety of yoga or meditation in a past life, and it's something that in this incarnation or lifetime I was attracted to. I think it's something I started in some previous life and had made a little bit of progress on, but hadn't completed, and therefore I was coming back. I've come back to take it up again. Hmm. That's the way I analyze it myself, really.
Okay.
There's some interesting little bits of family history also. You know, during World War II, my father had been stationed in India and was flying transport planes from India over the Himalayan mountains to...
Oh, the hump.
To China, when the Chinese were fighting the Japanese during World War II. So if I, you know, look at my family history, there's some connections with India. And when I consider, I've always had a sense that I've existed before this lifetime, and I've always felt some identification on that level with this sort of thing. I mean, that's how I look at it. I'm just responding honestly to your question.
No, it's an excellent, you know, I want honesty, obviously. And, you know, when you and I first met in that little, it wasn't a coffee shop on the ship, it was kind of like the dining area. There was just...
Yeah, I think on the first day on the ship, mm-hmm. I met Robin and you, and we have talked before.
Oh, yeah.
On... You know, different radio shows, I think, several years ago.
It's amazing how people can meet and never meet until they finally, ultimately, meet.
But that was a really interesting experience, going on that cruise, being, both of us, I guess, being speakers and presenters on that cruise, going to the Mayan sites in Central America. One of the things that stood out for me in terms of the experience that I had was meeting the Mayan elder who guided us around Chichen Itza.
Mm.
Because I don't know if you recall, we were all kind of standing together with him in front of the great, you know, pyramid temple at Chichen Itza.
The Kukulcan Pyramid.
Yeah, the Mayan temple there. And he was saying, we've all met before in previous lifetimes, and we've all been brought together here for a purpose. And that was something that totally resonated with me. And another thing that I got out of my experience there was... And I spoke about this. This is one of the things I talked about on the cruise, was the nature of cyclical time, because a lot of people during December of 2012 were speaking about the Mayan calendar and its predictions. But what struck me about the Mayan calendar was its cyclical nature.
Mm.
There are vast cycles of time, according to the Mayan calendar, lasting millions and millions of years. Some of the larger cycles, you know, there's cycles within cycles. And that's very much like the concept of time in the Vedic cosmology of India, which is also cyclical and involves vast periods of time.
What's your idea on the idea that the Mayan culture actually derived from ancient Indian culture?
Some people have made some proposed. I think, I don't know if it's 100% derived from it. I think one of the reasons why there are similarities is because a lot of these ancient wisdom traditions were in touch with the same spiritual or higher dimensional realities, and it's reflected in their cultures, even though they're from different parts of the world. However, I also think there were transoceanic contacts going on thousands and thousands of years ago. In other words, it wasn't only a few hundred years ago that people started crossing the oceans in ships. I think there was intercontinental travel going on long before that, and you see some reflections of that. Some of the motifs in Central American temple art, such as elephants and lotus flowers and things like that, appear to have some Indian origin.
Well, you don't exactly find elephants wandering around in Mayan country.
Not today, or not at the time that those structures were built, yeah. Certainly not.
So how do they know?
I would say they may have been in contact with parts of the world like India where those things existed, and they may have been exchanging architects. There are a lot of similarities that people have noticed between, say, the temple structures in South India and the temple structures in Central America, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, just like today, countries spread their cultural influence all over the world. Like, you can find signs of American culture all over the world, signs of, you know, Japanese culture all over the world, or whatever. Doesn't mean that the whole world was American or the whole world is Japanese. Just means that their culture spread.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to George Washington University. You're enrolling, you're looking to be maybe a diplomat, foreign service officer. You're taking languages. You get into Sanskrit somehow.
Yes.
And that was your doorway to what? A whole new view of what?
Well, one thing that I found in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, especially the writings called the Puranas or the histories, were accounts of human populations existing on Earth for millions and millions and millions of years. And this was something completely different than anything I had learned from my teachers in high school or in university. It's an idea that's very common in very ancient wisdom traditions, the idea of a very long human presence on Earth going right back to the very beginnings of life. So I had to wonder, what is the status of those kinds of accounts of extreme human antiquity? Are they to be taken as simply mythological, or is there perhaps some factual basis for them? So that's what got me looking into the history of archaeology, along with an associate of mine, Richard Thompson,
mm-hmm.
who was a disciple of the same guru and had a similar interest in scientific questions related to the Vedic teaching.
This is after George Washington, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I left George Washington University and all universities in 1968.
So you basically only stayed 2 years or 3 years in that milieu.
That's right. Now, as I said, that was the path that I felt was necessary for me. I felt I had exhausted the possibilities for getting what I regarded as real knowledge in the university system. I just didn't see the connection between paying my tuitions and getting credits and satisfying this requirement and that requirement and, you know, for the kind of knowledge that I wanted.
That now, was very bold. And, you know, Michael, you deserve a lot of credit for that because very few kids, you know, remember, I'm of roughly the same generation, and I remember the 60s. I remember one of my dearest friends wanted to become an anthropologist, and his mommy wanted him to become a lawyer so he could make a lot of money. And I saw him sacrifice his dream, his passion, his interest for making a lot of money. And I guess it did something to me because I was roughly your same age when I said, no, I'm going to look for something different. That's not the kind of life I want. So obviously you had that same kind of aha moment when you looked around you and you said, you know, like that old song, is this all there is?
Yeah, that sort of thing. Now, because I am the way that I am, for another person, they find themselves very comfortably situated, say, in a formal educational institution. They thrive there. They couldn't really satisfy their desire for acquiring knowledge of the kind they want to acquire outside that. So, but what I learned as I was kind of growing up in the world is that there are different knowledge traditions in this world. You know, there's the Western university education system or tradition as it's developed over the past several hundred years. That's there. It's a very powerful institution. A lot has come out of it, but there are other knowledge traditions also. You know, there were people who have been investigating these other knowledge traditions, whether they're Native American knowledge traditions or African tribal knowledge traditions, or as I was looking into Indian spiritual knowledge traditions or disciplic succession. So those alternatives are there. And everyone, I suppose, has to make their own decision what they're going to commit to. So I've made my commitments, and I'm happy with them. Mm. But I'm not saying that my commitments have to be the commitments for everybody.
Okay, well, why don't you hold it there? When we come back, what I want to do is explore what got you looking seriously on this new path at who we are and where we came from and the fact that these ancient wisdom traditions actually may be telling us much more truth than, you know, contemporary Western academic studies. But we'll go to a break first. Actually, tonight we're introducing a new member of our Other Side of Midnight family, a gentleman named Michael Spent. Michael has written a song called The Other Side of Midnight, and we're playing it now. You're on The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest tonight is Michael Cremo. We shall return.
Cosmos, to the other side. Sailing through the cosmos, to the other side of midnight. Of midnight, of midnight, of midnight, of midnight.
And we are back. My guest this morning is Michael Cremo, and we're discussing how you go from straight-laced academia to actually following a path that takes you to real knowledge. Michael?
Yes. so, of course, it's a long process, but for me, but I had become a little bit dissatisfied with the knowledge factory aspect of the modern university education system, and I had become a little bit disillusioned because I'd gone to the George Washington University to prepare myself for a career in some line of government or military service, possibly the diplomatic service or one of the intelligence services, because I had grown up among people in those lines of work. So I became a little bit disillusioned with the policies of the government at that time.
Well, this was the time of Vietnam.
Yes, during that time. Yeah, I became a little bit disillusioned with what the government and military agencies were doing at that time. And I also became a little bit disillusioned with the university knowledge system. So, you know, I was searching for other ways of existing in this world. And I was looking to find some other knowledge tradition that would satisfy the kinds of desires that I had, which involved getting to ultimate truths about the nature of the self, the nature of the universe.
You weren't asking much, were you?
And I was also concerned about being able to act as much as possible in the interest of all of the life forms on this planet, all of the people on this planet, without having to find myself artificially in opposition to them, to different categories of people, simply because of some temporary situations that sometimes arise because of the dealings of governments.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to deal with things on a level that was more truly international in the truest sense of the word. So that's what led me in the directions that I went. And then when I found a spiritual community that I could be part of, that and a knowledge tradition that satisfied my particular desires for certain types of knowledge, then it becomes a question, how are you going to act in the world? And my primary relationship to the world in terms of personal action has always been in form of writing and things related to writing, like research and speaking and things of that nature. That constellation of activities has always been central in the way that I've related to the world. And if I hadn't gone in the direction that I had gone in, that writing and speaking talent probably would have been absorbed in something else. Maybe I'd be working on government or corporate propaganda for something.
Or you'd be solving the problems in the Middle East right now. I mean, who knows?
Yeah. So, I don't know that if I'd gone that way, I'd be solving problems. I'd be probably, as more often happens, creating problems. But, so what I've part of the spiritual path that I followed, purpose, as part of your practice of yoga and meditation. So I look at the work that I do, for example, in writing books about archaeological anomalies as part of my practice of yoga and meditation, in the sense that you have to be active in this world and you have to engage your mind and senses in some kind of activity. So how are you going to engage your mind and senses in terms of practical activity in the world that somehow or other contributes to your more personal and global goals?
I'd like to move, you know, because we don't have a lot of time. We only have 2 hours, and we're actually now into the, you know, last hour and a half.
Take it wherever you'd like to
go. I'd like to know, you and Richard had the same guru, Richard Thompson. How did you decide to wind up writing, as I have said to every one of my friends over the last 10, 15 years, the 25-pound doorstop, Forbidden Archaeology?
Yeah. Well, we had, first of all, worked on, we agreed to work together on a smaller publication first. It was a magazine-style publication called Origins.
Mm-hmm.
Probably others have used that title as well, but in 1984, we brought out a publication called Origins, in which we laid out basic positions on the questions of cosmology, the origin of life, the origin of consciousness, the origin of species, and the origin especially of the human species. And then what we decided to do was take each topic in the magazine and expand it into a book. And basically, I was given the topic, you know, we decided that I should work primarily on the questions related to the origin of the human species. And the first topic was human antiquity. So
diving right into that, the deep end of the pool.
Right. And Richard, at that time, initially, he was he was going to concentrate more on cosmology questions.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we were working together, yeah, in a sense, but we had our areas that we were focusing on. And the question that I was taking up was the antiquity of the human species.
Now, did you use as your departure point the idea that the Indian literature, the Vedas, actually seemed to be a window to a history that modern science was completely ignoring?
Yeah, because the Vedic writings speak of a very ancient human presence on this planet going back millions and millions and millions of years, right to the very beginning of the history of life on Earth, whereas the modern scientific consensus is that humans like us appeared less than 200,000 years ago on this planet, having evolved from more primitive ape-like ancestors. In other words, before 200,000 years ago, there were no humans like us. So
Well, when you were going to Georgetown, the big news in science in terms of human origins was Leakey and Olduvai Gorge and, you know, fossils that were, I think, 1.5 million. Arthur Clarke and Stanley Kubrick really, kind of scared everybody by a film called 2001, where Arthur posited, that human origins actually were something like 4 million years old. But again, in terms of an evolutionary development, and of course his major claim to historical paradigm shattering stuff was he proposed in the film, in the novel, that primitive humans had been exposed to some kind of super advanced high tech extraterrestrial influence, i.e. the monolith, and that had jump started all modern evolution, culminating with atomic bombs in orbit, as you remember that famous, 2 million-year jump cut. You came at this looking at this literature that we've actually been modern, technological, conscious, sapient beings, spiritual beings for millions and millions and millions of years here.
Yeah, and of course, often I've gone and presented these ideas at scientific conferences. That's one of my audiences, is the mainstream scientific community. And I've presented dozens of papers on these topics at meetings of the World Archaeological Congress, the European Association of Archaeologists. I've been invited to present these ideas at some of the leading scientific institutions in the world, like the Royal Institution in London, Russian Academy of Sciences, Ukrainian Academy of Sciences, and so forth. And when I go into these scientific audiences, I can't give them a statement from the ancient Sanskrit writings of India and expect them to take it as evidence of anything. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't fit into their paradigm of knowledge. But what I can do is make a prediction. I can say something like this. If what the ancient Sanskrit writings of India say about human antiquity is true, then we should expect to find, if we go carefully through the entire scientific literature, we should expect to find reports of discoveries of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints going back many millions of years. Now, if you look in the current textbooks, you're not going to find any such reports.
Nope.
But the current textbooks are what we call secondary literature. We should divide the scientific literature into two parts, the primary and the secondary. By primary scientific literature, we mean reports by professional scientists, in this case, archaeologists, geologists, and paleontologists, and other scientists digging into the earth, published in their peer-reviewed scientific journals, dealing with these things. Now, if you look into the primary scientific literature, say from the time of Darwin up to the present, then although you won't find these reports in the textbooks today, you will find reports published in the primary scientific literature detailing or documenting discoveries of human bones, human artifacts, and human footprints going back many millions of years.
Okay, let me stop you there, because I want to know the big question. What happens between primary scientists writing peer-reviewed papers, publishing in the literature, and the guys who write the textbooks? Who's filtering out the idea that humans are millions of years old and civilization is not just 6,000?
Well, that is what goes on.
No, that's not an answer. Why? Michael, why?
Why?
Who's in charge of censoring who we really are?
Well, of course, the scientists who are doing it don't think that they're hiding true evidence, which is known, would cause people to disbelieve in their theories. They think they're behaving as rational custodians of true knowledge. You know, and to really understand this process of knowledge filtration, I think it really helps to go through the works of people like Thomas Kuhn, who wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, the works of other historians of science and philosophers of science, who point out some of the perceptual problems that come into play when you've got scientists as a group who are committed to some dominant consensus or paradigm. What happens when they encounter evidence that is radically outside what they should be prepared to find according to their disciplinary commitments, to their paradigm? You know, there have been some interesting psychological experiments performed, you know, where you can show people cards. You know, you show them this card, that card, and then you show them a, say, like, a black six of hearts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because people are, you know, they just won't notice it, that it's black instead of red. But they're just so accustomed to... Mm-hmm.
So
they just don't notice.
I'm confused. I hate being confused. You're telling me that in the primary scientific literature, you have paleontologists and archaeologists who actually unearth evidence and publish in respected peer-reviewed journals evidence indicating that the human species, a highly intelligent human species, has been on this planet for millions of years. Not, you know.
Yeah, let's say anatomically modern.
Okay. And with an associated technology, because there's a whole bunch of artifacts. In fact, your book, the, you know, Forbidden Archaeology, is filled with striking examples of artifacts found entombed in rocks that have to be sometimes hundreds of millions of years old. But you're saying that between those papers and the guys who write the textbooks, all that gets nicely, quietly filtered out. Now, are we looking at mass psychosis, or are we looking at control?
I think a little bit of both. There's a political element that enters into this, because although there is diversity of opinion actually within the scientific world, I want to say, first of all, you know, 95% of the biologists and archaeologists today accept the Darwinian theory of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
But there are scientists who don't accept it. They're in an extreme minority today, supporters of intelligent design, for example, or the kinds of ideas that I'm proposing.
But wait, you're not in the intelligent design, the creationism, let's say Christian intelligent design school. You're looking at something much bigger and deeper and longer, right?
Right. Yes. So, but governments have managed to give the supporters of the currently dominant ideas an exclusive monopoly in the education systems. They don't allow any alternative ideas, although alternative ideas are there.
So it is control.
And, yeah, there's that element.
Okay, so hang on. So if there's control, why is there control? Why aren't they following the precept of science, which is go ever wherever the truth leads?
Ultimately, I think it has to do with power. You know, there are lots of different kinds of power in the world. There's military power, there's economic power, there's political power, there's also intellectual power. And those who have power particularly monopoly power, they don't really like to give it up very easily. So if you've got a group of scientists who's managed to get a monopoly in the scientific institutions and educational institutions, it doesn't want to give up its position very easily. But the interesting fact is that the scientific monopoly is also supported by those who are monopolizing power in the economic circles and government circles as well. I think the reason for that is this. The answers that the scientific community is now giving to the important questions, who am I and where did I come from, are very materialistic. You know, they're basically telling us we're machines made of molecules in competition with each other for survival. And that mentality influences our values and our goals. It means we tend to think that the most important aspect of human life is the production and consumption, the ever-increasing production and consumption of more and more material things, which has damaging effects on the environment. And because this production and consumption system is also based on dividing the human population into competing groups, it's also the cause of a lot of conflict for the control of material resources on this planet, like oil and different metals and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole process generates a tremendous amount of wealth, which flows in unequal ways into certain pockets. And but it's all based on keeping people convinced that they should be good producers and consumers of more and more material things in competition with others. And that system is kept going by indoctrinating people in this idea you're machines made of matter in competition with each other for survival. And I think the powers that be recognize that the alternatives to that kind of identity, what if people were thinking, hey, we're not just machines made of matter in competition with each other for survival. We're beings of pure consciousness from some higher level of reality. And somehow or other, we've become temporarily associated with matter. But this is not our real home. We belong at some higher level of consciousness or reality. One effect of that, if that's what was being taught in the education systems, would be that people would be putting less of their energy into material production and consumption in competing groups.
Why is that axiomatically true, Michael? Because as long as we're here in this 3D reality, it's better to live in a palace than in a hovel. It's better to be fed than to be starving. It's better to be well than sick. Why would the two be so incompatible in terms of our visitation to this dimension?
Well, we have to look and see how we're doing.
Well, we're doing terribly at the moment.
So that kind of implies there is some incompatibility there.
Well, is it inherent or is it in how it's being mismanaged?
It's how it's being mismanaged. Because it would be possible for human beings on this planet to figure out how to satisfy the material needs of all the people on this planet in the most natural, efficient, and fair way possible. It should be possible to do that while putting a lot of more energy into developing the resource of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of seeing we're all in competing groups, understanding we're all from the same place ultimately. We're all part of the same human family, and we should be able to find ways to work things out. Now, if so it should be possible to find a way to satisfy our material needs, so in the most natural and efficient way possible. I think there are people who are trying to do that.
Like?
I think a lot of people are. But unfortunately, the people who are trying to do those things are caught up in social, political, and economic, and financial, and scientific and educational institutions that are based on this other paradigm. So that even though they have intentions, good intentions, they get co-opted in various ways.
Okay, when we come back, because we're coming up to a break here, I want to talk about the specifics in your first book with Richard, Forbidden Archaeology, the actual evidence, some of the artifacts, where they were found, maybe a couple of stories about who found them and then how the evidence magically disappeared, maybe some of the folks who were involved in the artifacts and the knowledge disappearing, certain institutions that we kind of, you know, see as household terms, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Smithsonian, and all that.
Sure.
But let us pause for a break. My guest this morning is Michael Cremo. We are talking about ancient human history. We're talking about ancient derivations of our. I'm having a problem here. Of our origins, our ultimate destinations, and why, for instance, it's incompatible with certain aspects of what we term materialism. Here on the other side of midnight, my name is Richard C. Hoagland. Will she be right back? And we are back. You know, the problem, Michael, is that when you start disparaging technology, sometimes it revolts and it doesn't want to play on cue. So let's go to the book. Let's go to Forbidden Archaeology and tell me the process of finding this astonishing evidence that you arrayed in, again, what I've called the 25-pound doorstop.
Yeah, some people call it Forbidden Archaeology because it's just too heavy to pick up.
Well, you guys actually published a shorter, abbreviated version because the book, the first book, is really massive. It's a tome. In every sense of that word.
900 pages.
Gosh,
yeah, the shorter edition is called The Hidden History of the Human Race.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the bigger edition sells more than the shorter edition.
Because it's got all the good stuff in it.
Go figure. So, I didn't start out thinking it was going to be a 900-page book because when I first started the research on forbidden archaeology, I thought, okay, maybe I'll do 8 days of research and I'll find a few interesting facts and I'll write, a short little pamphlet about it and go on to some other questions. But as I started digging into the primary scientific literature in archaeology from the time of Darwin up to the present in a lot of different languages. Because of my background, I have a reading of many of the European
languages. You could read the original papers in the original languages.
Yes. French, Italian, Spanish, German, Portuguese, so on.
Mm-hmm.
So as I started digging into the original reports, especially from the period around the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, because I was thinking, okay, The Origin of Species was published, Darwin's book, The Origin of Species, was published in 1859. So I figured, okay, after that.
Just before the Civil War over here.
on this side, yeah. So I figured, all right, scientists are going to start looking for evidence for missing links between ancient apes and modern humans. So I decided, okay, let's see what they were finding. So what I was very curious or very surprised to find was that instead of finding missing links during the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, and the latter part of the 19th century, scientists were reporting finding anatomically modern human bones and teeth and artifacts going back many, many millions of years.
This is in the scientific literature.
Yeah. Now, for example, the California gold mine discoveries, which were reported by Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was a Harvard University-educated geologist. He was the chief government geologist of California. He reported on the human bones and human artifacts that were found in the Sierra Nevada mountains in the California gold mining region. Miners were finding human bones, human artifacts, in layers of rock that modern geologists tell us go back to the early part of the geological period called the Eocene.
So hang on, let me picture the scene here. You've got thousands of people flooding to California in the 1840s and 50s and 60s looking for gold with picks and shovels, and they're fanning out all over the hills, and they're doing placer mining, and they're basically digging up everything they can looking for gold. And in the process, you've got thousands of people doing this. They're finding weird stuff.
Well, especially when they start digging into the sides of mountains, digging tunnels, extending thousands of feet beneath unbroken layers of rock in the sides of mountains. If you're panning for gold in a stream bed or digging through surface deposits, then anything that you might find could be dismissed as being fairly recent.
So it was the hard rock miners digging deep tunnels into, you know, we've all seen the westerns, we've all seen those movies. It was those guys who were coming across these serendipitous finds, and this chief geologist for California was smart enough to realize, wait a minute, there's something really interesting going on here.
Right. So he went out to investigate. He went out to the sites himself. He collected the artifacts. He carefully examined the situations in which they were found. And he published a monograph. A monograph is a detailed scientific report. It's called the Auriferous Gravels of California.
Oh, that's a catchy title. Yeah,
that means the gold-bearing gravels of California, and he detailed what was found in them. And this was published by Harvard University's Museum of Comparative Zoology in 1880. And
did that eventually turn into the Peabody Museum?
It may be. They call it the Museum of Comparative Zoology, which is still there, I believe, at Harvard. And as I said, what made these things so interesting to me is that according to modern geologists, the layers of rock in which these human bones and human artifacts were found date back to the early part of the geological period called the Eocene. So basically what was happening...
Which is like how long ago is the Eocene? For those of us that don't have a geological calendar on our walls...
About 50 million years ago, the early part of the Eocene.
Oh, just 50 million. Oh, okay.
50, 50.
50, yes. I'm being slightly facetious, Michael. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, sometimes when I'm speaking in different countries, foreign countries, and they translate, I listen. I was in Czech Republic once in Prague, and I was giving a talk, and the translator, when I said 50 million years, he said 50,000. But because I understood a little bit of Czech, I could tell when, you know, he said tisíc, which means thousand, instead of milion, you know.
Right.
So I said, no, not 50,000, 50 million. He goes, oh, really, 50 million.
Wow. I bet that caused a ripple in the audience.
Now, when I look for cases, I look for cases that demonstrate two things. First of all, extreme human antiquity. And this is extreme human antiquity, 50 million years.
Okay, again, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I really want to get this point driven home. You did not expect to find this kind of dating and these kinds of robust scientific discoveries in mainstream Harvard documented research. I mean, you must have been stunned.
Yeah, I was. And not only that, but I was also, you know, I found what was the reaction to it, how the knowledge filtering process
worked. Ah, yeah, I want to get to that.
And in this particular case, the scientist most responsible for the knowledge filtering was William Holmes, who was an anthropologist working at the Smithsonian Institution. And, you know, he was upset with Whitney that, you know, a Harvard-educated geologist would publish such a report. And his point, as he expressed it in a Smithsonian Institution publication, was if Dr. Whitney had really understood the theory of evolution, he wouldn't have come to those conclusions. In other words, if the facts didn't support the dominant theory that was emerging in the world of science at that time, those facts shouldn't have been published.
Do you think he was just dumb, not understanding the scientific method, which is that observations trump theory every time? Or do you think he was part of a deliberate knowledge filter designed to eliminate our real history?
Well, I think, you know, if we look at how Thomas Kuhn describes scientific revolutions, a scientific revolution was in progress at that time, and scientists around the world were becoming more and more heavily committed to a Darwinian evolutionary explanation of human origins that had humans appearing rather late in the fossil record. So, and actually, Whitney was not alone in uncovering archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity. There were scientists in Europe who were also finding human artifacts in layers of rock going back many millions of years ago and publishing their results in the peer-reviewed scientific literature of the time. Now, the problem was, it wasn't until the 1890s that scientists found their first real missing link. And that was the Java Man discoveries that were made in Indonesia by a Dutch researcher named Eugene Dubois.
He wasn't he from South Africa, though?
No, he was from the Netherlands.
Oh, okay.
And he went out to Indonesia to do research. He was looking for the missing link, you could say.
You mean pre Cro-Magnon?
Yeah, Cro-Magnon is Homo sapiens.
Yep, it's us,
anatomically modern human.
Yeah.
So, and scientists had discovered some Neanderthal bones, but they considered them just to be diseased specimens of anatomically modern type humans.
But if the California geologists in the 1880s had published in Harvard evidence, you know, anthropological evidence, bones, I presume, that were modern, and
yes.
they were, you know, ancient, really ancient. How did Dubois insert his new discoveries in the lineage and completely muck up the timeline?
Well, the timeline wasn't really fixed. Darwin published Origin of Species in 1859. Scientists start looking for the missing link, but the timeline isn't really fixed. So what they're finding, but they're not finding initially missing links. They're finding evidence for a human presence.
Mm-hmm.
And because the evolutionary timeline hasn't really been fixed, therefore scientists like Whitney in California could publish his results. And then in Europe, researchers like Carlos Ribeiro in Portugal could report finding human artifacts and layers of rock 20 million years old. In Belgium, Dr. Routot could report finding human artifacts in layers of rock 30 million years old, and so on and so on. But in 1890, they find their first missing link.
You mean a primitive fossil that's definitely not modern human?
Well, even then, there's some debate. What Dubois found is a skull cap that was ape-like and a thigh bone that was human-like, but he thought a little primitive. And he put the two together, and it became the Java ape man, which he called Pithecanthropus erectus, and modern scientists class it now Homo erectus, an ape man of some kind. And it was found in layers of rock that are now considered to be about 800,000 years old. In other words, about a million years old, you could say, roughly.
Now, just yesterday compared to the previous findings, how did the previous findings get totally sidetracked?
Well, see, now they've got their missing link. And then it becomes a problem what to do with this evidence that's accumulated. See, Dubois' discovery of Java Man was in the 1890s, 1893, and it gradually became accepted by 1894, 1895. Then it becomes a problem. Well, what if you've got your ape man, your link, at a million years? What do you do with all this evidence that's accumulated in the 1860s, 1870s, and 1880s? That's when you get scientists like Holmes, William Holmes, saying about Whitney and others like him, if they really understood the theory of evolution, if they had had the benefit of this Java Man discovery, then they would have realized you can't have humans before Java Man. I mean, that's how it was actually carried out.
So it's like kind of like a religious perspective where the theory of evolution became a dogma, and any evidence that was against the dogma was simply thrown out or suppressed.
Right, and then here's another interesting thing. However, even after Java Man was discovered, discoveries continued to be made showing anatomically modern humans existed millions of years ago, but they were just interpreted in such a way as to somehow fit the theory. And this happened just this year. Now, this is an example. I can give you an example from just this year, 2015.
Oh, by all means.
And it was a discovery that was made in Ulduvai Gorge. It's a small discovery, but it's very meaningful in terms of the
where Leakey did his work back in it's northeast Africa.
Right, in Tanzania.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group of archaeologist who published this year in Nature Communications, which is one of the Nature family of publications.
Kind of like the British Science Express.
Yeah, it's like the Nature is the world's leading scientific publication today. And they published a report that a finger bone was found at Olduvai Gorge, and they carefully measured it, and they compared the measurements with the measurements of the finger bones of baboons, chimpanzees, monkeys, gorillas, different kinds of ape men like Homo habilis, Homo erectus, and Homo sapiens. And they said, we can exclude it from all the ape and ape men groups, and it's exactly like that of a modern human being.
And how old?
And it was found in layers of rock 1.84 million years old.
Oh, boy.
In other words, 1,840,000 years old. So in their scientific report, scientists say this human bone, by its affinities, is modern human, but we can't attribute it to Homo sapiens because of the geological age of the formation in which it's found. You know, so it's just a perfect example of how the knowledge filtering process operates. The knowledge filtering process can operate retroactively, as it did, say, in the case of William Holmes saying, okay, Whitney was wrong to think that discovered human bones and human artifacts going back 50 million years, because obviously that's just not possible. So he kind of wiped out Whitney's discoveries retroactively. But the knowledge filtering process continues to operate, not retroactively, but in real time, you know, as scientists look at evidence today. So even today, you know, scientists can encounter evidence for extreme human antiquity, but they just don't see it as that.
Well, wait. Do they not see it, or are they operating in a religious club where if they publish the real data and the real analysis, they'd be kicked out of the club and never publish again, never get a grant, never go on an expedition, they wind up, you know, Uber drivers?
Yeah. Well, it's something like, you know, are you familiar with the Gestalt drawings that look one way to one person?
Oh, there's very, very famous Escher, William Escher.
Yeah, but there's one that shows, like, depending upon how you look at it, it looks like either an old woman or a young woman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of these Gestalt kinds of drawings where a figure will look like one thing if you look at it from one point of view, and you look at it from another, it looks like it's the same image, but it just looks different to different people. You know, so I think it's obvious to me these scientists are looking at this little bone, this finger bone. They're saying it's totally human, but it can't be human.
But that's there's a psychological term for that. It's called disconnection, or there's a technical psychology term for it. How do they sleep at night? Do they really believe they can just toss the evidence aside because it can't be, and it's found in a place where it can't be? I mean, revolutions are based on things that break the paradigm. And only, remember, there's this old Apache saying, it only takes one white crow to prove all crows aren't black.
In an ideal inductive system, that would be true. But they tend to think everything is really working our way, so we can't let every little anomaly bother us.
That's not science. You know, it's, you remember Sagan's great, you know, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary evidence?
I don't accept that.
It's nuts. It's totally nuts. It's political. Carl was obviously trying to subvert the scientific process, because if you start evaluating, as I've said over and over on this show, scientific evidence on a psychology rating, you know, this is normal, this is average, this is kind of trivial, that's extraordinary. If you begin to separate evidence psychologically, you can create a paradigm where no amount of evidence is ever extraordinary enough to support the extraordinary hypothesis. You can always move the goalposts to where it's never extraordinary enough. It sounds to me like finding a modern human finger bone in a strata that's, you know, almost 2 million years old was not extraordinary enough for the guys who found it. Or, and the other model is, someone came to them and said, if you publish what you really think, you'll never work in this town again.
That could be, I think, all those are real possibilities.
Well, when you have referee journals where you have referees who are hidden, who are anonymous, who can basically scapegoat and kill your paper without you ever knowing who they are, where they work, what their names are, what their affiliations are, what their, you know, what they like for dinner, you have a system where you basically have created a systemized institutional knowledge filter to keep everybody fat, dumb, and happy, and stash all the good stuff in a big vault, like in the Indiana Jones movie, and you close the door.
Yeah, if they were actually storing it in some nice vault, that would be good. But
well, don't you think there's actually two parallel tracks? There's the science we see, and then the science we don't get to see.
Like, yeah, in a sense, say like the California gold mine discoveries.
Yeah.
For the average person, they don't exist, but the artifacts are in the collection of the Phoebe Hearst Museum of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley.
So they haven't disappeared. Because a lot of the things in Forbidden Archaeology, Michael, have disappeared, literally disappeared, like those little spheres in South Africa with the little scores around their equators that look like the moon Iapetus, you know, the moon orbiting Saturn.
Right.
They're gone.
At least some of them are gone.
Mm-hmm.
There's a picture of that object in my book, Forbidden Archaeology. And when the book came out, you know, a television producer in Holland, in the Netherlands, got in touch with me and said he wanted to go to South Africa and film it, take mm-hmm. some video footage of it to use it in some documentary.
Mm-hmm.
So I put him in touch. You know, we had gotten the photograph from the director of the Museum of Natural History in a museum in South Africa, in the town of Klerksdorp is where the museum was located.
Just to be clear for folks that don't know what we're talking about little tiny metallic spheres, maybe what, an inch across, an inch and a half?
Inch or 2 inches.
And they have grooves, they have like three grooves around the equator. They're symmetrical, they're perfectly spherical. And they were found in strata, if I remember correctly, that are like 2.5 billion, with a B, billion years old, which is incredibly ancient before any technology or any artificial gadget should be found anywhere on the planet.
Yeah, so this Dutch television producer wanted to go and see the particular object that was shown in the photograph in Forbidden Archaeology. So I put him in touch with the museum director at the Klerksdorp Natural History Museum, and the director replied to us, that object has been stolen from the museum. And he characterized the person who stole it as a white witch.
What?
So I hope it's being put to good use somehow.
A white witch? That sounds like one hell of a story all by itself.
Yeah, I mean, all of this evidence involves incredible stories. when you get into the knowledge filtering aspect of it.
But the California Gold Rush outer place artifacts and human remains are in a museum in California sanctioned by the state of California, and anybody can go and look at these things?
Well, they're not displayed to the public.
Why not?
They are kept in a storage building several miles from the museum. Now, I did get to see them. Now, when Forbidden Archaeology was first published.
I tell you what, why don't you hold it there? Because we have another break, our last break coming up. This morning is Michael Cremo. We're discussing ancient artifacts that do not belong in terms of the current evolutionary theory of humans' origins, but they're there, and some of the oldest ones are billions of years old, and they have this nasty habit of when you point them out and make them kind of a cause célèbre, they disappear. This music is from Bobby Bright. It's The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
To wander through the mansions in your mind, nothing to lose, there's everything to find. Other side of midnight, on the other side of midnight, the day has just begun, but somewhere on this pale blue dot, it's midday in the sun that shines on everyone at some time in the day, and everyone's got something to say. Other side of midnight.
And we are back. My guest this morning is Michael Cremo. We're discussing the real hidden history of humankind. You know, Michael, this idea that mainstream science is really just dumb and stupid, and they see things and they just don't get it because they're stuck in the paradigm, is part and parcel the story of NASA's exploration of the planet Mars. I mean, the current mission, the current Curiosity mission, the rover, has been driving by for 2 or 3 years now, stunning artificial junk all over Gale Crater on Mars. And the imagery has been getting better and better and better. We had a whole show, you know, a few nights ago on this. And you watch the mainstream guys who are prosecuting the mission, the various team members, the various members of academia who are part of universities and writing papers on the discoveries, and they're totally focusing on the geology. They're totally ignoring the technology and the ethnology and the artifacts that are in every picture now, practically. And when they see something really interesting in a photograph, in a mass cam panorama, instead of following the trail of curiosity, they just drive by. I mean, it gives a whole new meaning to the concept of drive-by. So, again, is this just stupidity? Don't they see it? Or have they been told, if you break silence, if you break the code, if you reveal to the people who are paying for the missions what we're really finding, you'll never work in this town again?
Now, you correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that NASA actually has written directives that are publicly accessible that say they can only search for single-celled life forms or evidence for, you know, very, very primitive life forms, and they're not to mess around with anything humanoid or anything like that. Is that a fact?
No, as far as I know, there is no such directive. There is a National Science Foundation directive, which I heard about when we did a conference at the University of Wisconsin back in 2003, which is available on a set of videos that I put out called God, Man, and E.T., and we had one of our conference members who actually quoted the National Science Foundation directive that intelligent artifacts or intelligent design or any artificial perspectives on human history, prehistory, is basically verboten. It's you're not supposed to do that. You can't do that. You can't write papers on it if they're funded by, you know, National Science Foundation grants and all that. And I made the statement at the time, well, if that's true, and I forget who it was who told us this, it basically is a dagger through the heart of what we think of as science. What you're documenting, Michael, is this history goes way back, you know, decades and centuries in terms of filtering who we really are from the people who would benefit most from knowing who we really are.
Well, here's something really interesting. You know, as I was mentioning a little bit earlier, you know, sometimes I present papers about my work at meetings of the World Archaeological Congress, which is one of the world's largest international organizations of professional archaeologists. They meet every 4 to 5 years in a different country and hold a congress.
Mm-hmm.
And I present it. You know, so there are some scientists who are willing to listen, which is, I think, an important first step. But at the last 2 World Archaeological Congress meetings that I attended, there were sessions on extraterrestrial archaeology.
Really?
Yes. And
conducted by whom?
By professional archaeologists who are interested in these topics.
Holy cow.
One topic that they're interested in is the stuff that we've sent up to these places. You know, they're thinking when we go back to the moon or to Mars, you know, whose museum are the probes that we've sent up there. But they're also discussing, what if we find things that we did not send up there?
Really?
And actually, there are actually some treaties that are being developed among nations and at the United Nations about these issues. Who's going to own these artifacts?
Oh my God.
That may be found up there.
You've got to send
me
these papers.
A lot of people think, yeah. You know, I mean, it is kind of amazing what some people in the scientific community are interested in.
So this is kind of a quiet underground track of people who are looking ahead, who are bright enough to realize that this cover-up can't continue forever and it's going to collapse. And then they're interested is, well, who's going to own all that good stuff?
Well, that's what archaeologists do. Who's going to protect it? Who's going to conserve it? Who's going to...
I mean, this is going to make...
That's their business.
This is going to make the California Gold Rush look like you know, a candle flame compared to an H-bomb, because the solar system, Michael, as you and I have discussed, is filled with astonishing stuff, and it's not primitive stuff. It's from an incredibly advanced culture, and if we can find the libraries...
Yeah, well, I just thought given your long-standing interest in such things, I just thought you might be interested to know that there are some professional archaeologists who are openly talking about extraterrestrial.
Well, for God's sake, please send me their papers and send me their names, and I'll send them some data that will knock their socks off.
Yeah, let me just grab something off my bookshelf here and see if I can find something to give you right now.
Okay.
But just a second.
Okay. I mean, I'm just intrigued as heck the way history could have gone a whole different direction if Whitson, the California geologist, when he published that first paper on these remarkable out-of-place findings from the tunneling in the Gold Rush days, if that paper at Harvard had been strong enough and powerful enough with enough backing to basically divert the current knowledge filtering in a different direction.
Okay, I was off for a little bit. I've got something here. Let me see if I can find what I was looking for.
Well, we don't have to do this on the air. You can certainly send this to me afterwards, but I think the audience should know. I mean, this is really news tonight, Michael, that there are serious mainstream archaeologists who are quietly discussing out of sight of Fox and CNN the idea, the legitimate idea of extraterrestrial archaeology and artifacts left by somebody else, and they're already talking about who is going to own them.
Yeah.
Fascinating. But we don't have to get bogged down in who they are yet. Okay, you can do that to me when we're off the air. So let's move the conversation to back to Whitson. What happened after Whitson? I mean, we're talking about how you started filling the pages, the 900 pages of this tome. That was your first major discovery that there was real evidence to support the Vedas?
It was one of them. And then, you know, if you go through Whitney's reports and look at his footnotes, and he says, and then in Europe, another scientist found some similar things. And, you know, then you trace down those footnotes, and then you, you know, say those led me to the work of Carlos Ribeiro in Portugal, who had, you know, he was a geologist there who had discovered human artifacts and layers of rock 20 million years old.
Holy cow.
And then, you know, you look at the little footnotes in his report in Portuguese, and you find a reference to another scientist, and then you dig that up, and then one thing leads to another, and then finally you've got enough to fill up a 900-page book.
Wow.
So,
I mean, just let's kind of go down the list of the evidence, because I remember things like gold chains, and there was something in California in a geode that looked like a spark plug, and kind of just list some of the specifics, because the more specific we can be for an audience that's going to be obviously very skeptical,
well,
the better.
One category of evidence is human artifacts. Now, most of them that are reported in the scientific literature are of stone, like Dr. Whitney reported obsidian, spear points, stone mortars and pestles. And these may seem simple, but archaeologists normally attribute such things only to humans of our level of intelligence, not any kind of ape man.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are things that occur that are of the nature of metallic objects. For example, there was a report published in Scientific American in the year 1852 about a beautiful metallic vase that was found 15 feet deep in solid rock near Boston. Actually, the area of Boston is called Dorchester.
Mm.
So, according to geologists...
Dorchester, that's where Lawrence O'Donnell hails from.
Oh, okay. According to geologists of the United States Geological Survey, the formation there is called the Roxbury Conglomerate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's considered to be about 60 million years old from the Cambrian period. So,
wait. 60 million is far younger than the Cambrian. The Cambrian would be around 600 million. 600 million. Okay. See, those zeros are important.
Yeah, 600 million.
Yeah.
So that's another category of.
Well, wait. 600 million.
Metallic objects.
That's when supposedly on Earth there was nothing but little one-celled organisms. When you had the Precambrian explosion, 600 million, 575 million, that's when there was this huge explosion of multi-diverse life forms on Earth, but certainly nothing built by anybody that had intelligence. And you say this was a metallic vase buried in conglomerate rock?
Yes.
Wow. How big was it?
I gave the measurements in Forbidden Archaeology. I think it was something like 5 inches tall and 4 inches wide at the base, something like that. I don't have the measurements right here.
Well, roughly.
But it was around that size.
And where is it now?
That is a disappeared object.
Of course.
Yeah. And then, so then you've got objects that are human skeletal remains. So you've got stone tools, you've got metal objects, you've got human skeletal remains. For example, the human skeletons that were found by the Italian geologist Ragazzoni, Dr. Giuseppe Ragazzoni, in Italy at a place called Castagnetolo. They're from the Pliocene period, you know, between 3 and 4 million years old. And then, you know, I just mentioned that little finger bone that was found just this year in layers of rock almost 2 million years old at Aduvai Gorge.
Hmm.
Then you have footprints. That's an interesting category of evidence. In 2013, archaeologists found dozens of footprints at a place called Happisburg on the coast of England, and there they found dozens and dozens of footprints, and they carefully measured them, and they found they are the same size as modern human footprints, same size, same shape, and they were found in layers of rock about 2 million years old. About 1 million years old. But they wouldn't assign them to Homo sapiens because, according to their theories, Homo sapiens didn't exist.
How can legitimate scientists, peer-reviewed published scientists with academic degrees and backgrounds and colleagues and papers and, you know, house payments and car payments and, you know, they're human beings, how can they look at evidence like this and simply walk away? How can they not say, oh my God, there's a Nobel Prize in this if I pursue this?
Well, there are tremendous pressures for conformity in the scientific world, and there are prices that people pay. You know, like, for example, there's an American geologist I know, Virginia Steen McIntyre.
Oh, yes, her story is amazing. Please tell her story.
Who was involved in dating an archaeological site in Mexico, and she and her colleagues.
I thought it was California. Calico, California, I thought.
No. This site that she dated is the Huayatlico site.
Okay.
And it's near Puebla in Mexico. And she and her colleagues used 4 scientific methods to date the site: the zircon fission track method, uranium series method. Using all 4 methods, they concluded it must be about 250,000 or 300,000 years old. And
hang on, let me stop you there, because the conventional academic view of when humans first came to the North American continent, it's the last land bridge, roughly, what, 12,500 years ago, right?
Right. So
this blows that into, blows it into day before yesterday.
Yeah, so the archaeologists refused to publish the age for the site.
Amazing.
So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues independently published the age for the site, and that's when the hammer came down on them.
Wow. And what happened?
Well, Virginia Steen McIntyre lost a teaching position that she held at a university in the United States. Her career, up to that point, she had been a rising star in terms of her advancement in her career in geology. But after that, her career was just finished.
So this is not ignorance. This is definite control.
Yeah. I came across some information about the archaeologists who are interested in extraterrestrial archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
This is from the meeting of the World Archaeological Congress that took place in Washington, D.C. in 2003. They had a whole session there called Space Heritage and the Potential for Exo-Archaeology in the Solar System.
Oh, my God.
National and International Perspectives. And they have several, and it was chaired by John B. Campbell and Beth O'Leary.
Okay.
And they were talking not only about know, they're talking about the UN Outer Space Treaty implies that space heritage and is both national and international, but with a confusing contradiction that the equipment belongs to the country which sent it to the site. Yeah, you know, like in other words, they're discussing what to do with stuff.
Yeah, but they're talking about our stuff. Contemporary civilization, yeah.
But they're also talking about other things that we didn't send up there.
Okay. Now, what universities were they associated with, or are they associated? Are they still associated? Why didn't something happen to them, like, and I guess I'm leaping ahead of the story, to your friend, you know, Virginia McIntyre?
Okay, let's see if I can find in this document what their affiliations were.
Again, we probably shouldn't take time on the air because people are, like, wondering.
Right, okay. Yeah. All right, so we can talk about something else then.
Okay. Well, I kind of want to back up now. We've documented enough evidence that any rational person has got to say, okay, we're not who you think we are. We're much more extraordinary than who we think the human race is. What's your meta picture? How have you put this together with your philosophy and your initial search for the path of knowledge that you embarked upon many, many years ago out of George Washington?
Well, as I mentioned in the beginning, I look at what I'm doing as part of my practice of yoga. And there are different kinds of yoga, but one practice of yoga is to take whatever your talent or ability is and use it for some higher purpose that's going to benefit humans on this planet in as much as possible. So that's how I look at what I'm doing. And the initial work that I did in forbidden archaeology led me into other topics. In forbidden archaeology, I presented archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity that contradicts the dominant theories about human origins today, but which is consistent with the accounts of human antiquity that we find in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India and other ancient wisdom traditions. So after that book was published, people asked me, well, okay, if you've got this evidence that contradicts the current theories of human origins, then what are you going to propose in place of those theories? So to answer that question, I wrote a book called Human Devolution, a Vedic Alternative to Darwin's Theory.
Hmm.
So,
and I think that book is listed on your guest page tonight on Other Side of Midnight, including some images that we put up there from the Indian Vedas that kind of illustrate some of the technology that's been described in the Vedas, particularly image number 4, which is a Vimana, which has been described in various ways. This one is from, I guess, 1923, was when this author or this writer depicted from the text what a Vimana looked like. And it's basically an ancient spaceship. It's an anti-gravity flying spaceship that is in the Vedas.
Right. And so then that book led into questions of cosmology, which, you know, sometimes I do speak about Vimanas, spacecraft, and I appeared in a few episodes of the Ancient Alien series that aired on the History Channel, and the contribution that I tried to make, not that I necessarily agree with everything that was on the series, but the contribution that I was trying to make was that the ancient Sanskrit writings do have elaborate accounts of spacecraft. And yeah, so the original concentration on stones and bones inevitably leads to questions of cosmology, the nature of consciousness, extraterrestrial life. And
well, let me stop you there. We only got a couple of minutes, but if these guys, again, published mainstream science until they're suppressed, are finding evidence of the human form, the current human form, like in the footprints, million years ago or more, what does that tell us about the human form, Michael, in the cosmos, in the universe?
According to the ancient Sanskrit writings, there are 400,000 human-like species, all related to each other, all coming ultimately from the same source.
So the family, as I've termed it.
Yes, I was making that reference, recalling what you said earlier in the show, which is something that I agree with, that there would be a family resemblance or a family connection, not a resemblance, a family connection among all of these 400,000 human-like species scattered throughout the cosmos.
Wow.
So that's... I started with the stones and bones, and it eventually led to all these other topics as well.
Well, obviously, Michael, we've only scratched the surface, using the old cliche. The show has ended, at least this show. There will be others, and there's going to be new evidence. Obviously, behind the scenes, you will provide me with the connection to the World Archaeology Congress and the folks that are brave enough and powerful enough to maintain a paradigm that there is such a thing as extraterrestrial archaeology. And in our next conversation, whenever that takes place, I guess we'll pick up the story where we left it tonight. Michael, thank you again. My guest tonight has been Michael Cremo. We've been discussing the ancient origins of the human species. This is The Other Side of Midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. Until tomorrow morning, same time, same channel, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning.